was only with the advent of the Abhidhamma that the four immaterial states were called jhanas. And so now we have eight jhanas. This is a useful thing, and although probably most of you are not going to be experiencing the higher jhanas, it's kind of interesting to see what the human mind is capable of doing. When you're in the fourth jhana, many people find that they're slumped over. Okay. It helps if you get your energy back up if you're going to do the higher jhanas, the immaterial states. Before I give you the actual states themselves, I should mention that sometimes the first four jhanas are referred to as the fine material jhanas, the rupa jhanas. Rupa means materiality. And then the higher jhanas are the arupa, the immaterial jhanas. The first four are called rupa jhanas not because they are material, they're mental states, obviously, but one reason could be that they are experiences that we've had in the material world. We've all experienced rapture, happiness, contentment, and quiet stillness. In fact, there's a simile in the Visuddhimagga that really kind of spells out what this is like. You're lost in the desert. You don't have any water. It's a pretty dangerous situation. You come over a little rise, and in the distance you see what might be palm trees. You get excited. You head towards them. They don't disappear. Eventually you start meeting people. They have wet hair. They have bundles of wet clothing. It's an oasis. You get really excited. First jhana. You come to the oasis, it's beautiful, all these palm trees, big pool of water, you are so happy. Second jhana. You drink the water, you get in, you cool off, when you climb out, you are contented, satisfied. Third jhana. And then you lie down in the shade of a tree and have a rest. Fourth jhana. And this very much is like what the mind goes through as it moves through these jhanic states. But these arupa jhanas, they're quite different. So as I said, if you're slumped over in the fourth jhana, get your energy up a bit. And then, what it says is, sorry. By passing entirely beyond bodily sensations, by the disappearance of all sense of resistance, and by non-attraction to the perception of diversity, seeing that space is infinite, one reaches and remains in the realm of infinite space. Totally clear, right? Okay. All right. So, by passing entirely beyond bodily sensations, these states are subtle enough that you're not noticing your body. Okay. In the first four jhanas, you drench, deep, saturate, and suffuse your body with the rapture and happiness, or the happiness free from rapture, or the pure, bright mind. So you obviously have bodily awareness. But these immaterial states, there's no more bodily awareness. And then it says, by the disappearance of all sense of resistance and by non-attraction to the perception of diversity, seeing that space is infinite. Okay, so the best way to explain this is to give you the instructions. What Ayakema told me was get in touch with the boundaries of my being and then expand them to fill the room. And then expand them to fill the building. And then the retreat center. And just keep expanding till I hit the horizon and keep going. Don't go past the moon and Mars and Jupiter. Just expand. All right? Just stay focused on this outward expansion. When she told me that, my reaction was, oh no, she's gone New Age on me. It just sounded completely hokey. I mean, how could that do anything? But with Ayakema, you wouldn't say something like that, right? It was like, okay, I'm going to go back and I'm going to do the very best I can with this expansion stuff. So I got into the fourth jhana and got in nice and deep. And then I come out and I get the sense of my body and the boundaries of my being, and I start expanding them. And I just focused on further, further, further away. And then eventually this huge space up and opened up in front of me. I mean, it was a big space. It was unlimited. That was the fifth jhana. It says the realm of infinite space. Actually, at the time of the Buddha, they didn't have the concept of zero. So they probably didn't have the concept of infinity. But they did have the concept of limitless or without bound, boundless space. And that's what this is. It's a big space. If you're visual, you'll probably see the space. It may be off-white or light gray, or it may be black. If it's black, it's like outer space, but there's no stars or planets or galaxies or anything like that. It's just a big black space. If it's white or light gray, there might be a horizon line, or there might not. Doesn't matter. If you're not a particularly visual person, you may not see the space, but you'll know it's there somehow. I can't really tell you how, because I'm very visual and I see it every time. But in talking with students who are not so visual, they say they can feel the space in front of them. It's sort of like you're in the Arizona desert and you're just walking along and there's sand and cactus and there's not anything, and suddenly you come to the Grand Canyon. I mean, it's a big place, only there's no bottom and there's no other side. It's just this gigantic space. It's pretty much unmistakable. Now, what Aya told me was the boundaries of my being, but it doesn't matter what you expand. I had one student who was very imaginative, and she took an imaginary balloon and started blowing it up bigger, 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 until it popped, and there was the infinite space. She was also the one who took a flashlight, a torch, and followed the beam of light further, 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 until it illuminated the space. So anything you can do to get your attention going out further and further and further without limit can take you to the fifth jhana if you're concentrated enough. Now, it's very important while you're doing the expansion to not look for the space. If you look for the space, you're not focused on the expansion and the space won't show up. You've got to stay right out on the edges of the expansion, and that's all that you're aware of. When the space appears, you'll know it. It's pretty obvious. For most people, there's a very tiny sense of an observer and the whole big space in front of them. You may not even notice the observer. It's just big space, all right? And it's only perhaps after you come out you realize, oh yeah, there was a tiny observer. Or it may take you getting multiple times into the fifth jhana before you even notice there's an observer. When it's really strong, there's not only a big space in front of you, it's below you, behind you, above you. You're suspended in the middle of it. But that's when it's really strong. Most people, when they first get it, it's just a big space in front of them. When it appears, put your attention on the spaciousness and hang out there. Don't check to see if you can notice your body. If you do, you'll notice your body and fall out of the space. All right. It's only afterwards that you might think, oh yeah, I completely forgot about my body. It was just this big space. You want to be able to get there and then learn to stay there for 5, 10, maybe even 15 minutes. You get really stabilized on it. And then when you can do that, you could try moving to the sixth jhana. And by passing entirely beyond the realm of infinite space, seeing that consciousness is infinite, one reaches and remains in the realm of infinite consciousness. Not a lot of instruction there. Okay. The move that you want to make is to realize that you can't be conscious of an infinite space with a limited consciousness. Your consciousness has to be as big as whatever you're conscious of. And so the trick is to move your attention from the space to turn your consciousness back to your consciousness. Become aware of your awareness. All right, so big space, and then you turn to look at the mind that is aware of this big space. It's a kind of tricky thing to do. If I hold up the stick and I say, are you aware of the stick? Yeah, everybody can be aware of the stick. Now, can you become aware of your awareness of the stick? That's a little more tricky. If you're going to practice the fifth jhana, the sixth jhana, you might practice looking at something and then becoming aware of your awareness of whatever you're looking at. Okay? Because the space is a lot more subtle than the stick. Okay, so you're there in the fifth jhana, the big space. You turn your attention back to become aware of your awareness, become conscious of your consciousness. And when you do, it feels like you become absorbed into the space, and then your mind becomes as big as the space. Your mind is without limit, infinite. Most people who describe it visually say, it's dark. That's it. You know, it's just dark. There's not really anything to see. But there's a sense of the mind is really, really big. If you come from a spiritual tradition where you're looking for union with Atman, union with the higher self, or union with Brahma, or something like that, you might think that you have arrived. I mean, it's me, and my consciousness is as big as the universe. How could it be anything else? Well, sorry. It's just an experience that you're having, and you're interpreting it that way. The Buddha never talked about there being any big thing out there to have union with. All right? So there's no Brahma to go have union with. There's no Atman or higher self or anything like that. You're just having an experience, and it feels like you've become an infinite mind. Cool. All right? That's all it means. Now, sometimes if you're really, really good, it's possible that it may seem like there are other consciousnesses within that consciousness. A few little consciousnesses over here, a few little consciousnesses over there. It's not like you can read the minds of other people in the room. It just feels like it's like that. But you've got to have a really, really good sixth jhana for that to happen. I've been practicing the sixth jhana since 1991, and I've only had it happen to me maybe, I don't know, 6, 8 times. So it's pretty uncommon. But when it does, it's kind of interesting. But again, it's just an experience. It doesn't have any greater meaning or anything like that. You want to learn to get there from the fifth jhana by doing the turning back. And then you want to learn to stabilize it again for 5 to 10 to 15 minutes. Get good at hanging out that. And then, And by passing entirely beyond the realm of infinite consciousness, seeing that there is no thing, one reaches and remains in the realm of no thingness, the realm of nothingness. All right? So, it's translated here as no hyphen thingness, which actually is pretty good. It's an experience where there's nothing there, no thing to experience. In the fifth jhana, there's space to experience. In the sixth, there's consciousness to experience. And in the seventh, there's nothing to experience. Big nothing. All right, to get there, you're in the sixth jhana. There's this infinite consciousness. What is the content of that infinite consciousness? Well, the sense of space is actually long gone. And when you look, that consciousness is not conscious of anything. It's conscious of nothing. Put your attention on that sense of nothing. If you do, you'll get a beach ball size sense of nothing. All right? So there's a nothing right in front of you. And, yeah, I know. All right, so you got a nothing and you're focused on nothing. And you get it a little stable and you look at the edges and there's nothing at the edges. I mean, there's not any edges really to be found. And then you look some more and there's nothing over here and there's nothing over there. It's sort of like you go down into the basement and you hit the light switch and then nothing happens. There's no light. It's dark. And you're trying to see what's in the basement. There's nothing right in front of you, right? And then as your eyes begin to adjust, well, there's nothing over here, and there's nothing over there. Why, there's nothing down here at all. That's more like what the seventh jhana is like. If you're visual, you'll most likely see it in one of two ways. The first way is it's dark. It's black. It's deep purple, it's dark blue, and there's nothing. It's just this empty space with nothing in it. The other possible way it could show up, remember on the old TV, if you put it where there was no channel, you got black and white static? Imagine black and black static. Right? So it's just a sense of movement. But there's nothing, there's no thing there. The nothing is like, let's say you go to sleep tonight and somebody comes into this room and they take everything out. They take all the mats and the cushions and the chairs and the table and the plant and the candle. And you come in the morning and you go, there's nothing in here. It's that kind of nothing. Okay? Nothing at all to be found. It's not the same as emptiness that's talked about in the Mahayana tradition. We'll talk about emptiness on Saturday night. Okay, but this is, no thing can be found. That's why the translator had a good idea to put no thingness. All right, so it's an experience of there being nothing, no thing. Sometimes people stumble into this state unexpectedly. I know because I've had a fair number of people come to me for their first interview and they say something like, can I tell you about something that happened? And I say, yeah. And they say, I was on this long retreat, like maybe the 3-month course at IMS. And I was just meditating away, doing my Vipassana, and I fell into the void. And it was really scary. And I say, well, what happened next? Well, when I got out of it, I went running to the teacher, and what did they say? Well, they said I should get something to eat and take a shower and maybe don't meditate for a few days. Sounds to me like you fell into the seventh jhana. Well, I don't know what it was, but it was really scary. Okay, so time goes by. They learn the first 6 jhanas. And eventually they come in, okay, you got to 6 jhana, good. Here are the instructions for 7. I don't know if I want to go back there. No, it'll be all right. So I give them the instructions for 7. They go away from the interview. They come back 3 days later. Yeah, this is exactly where I was, only this time it wasn't scary. The only thing that was frightening was they didn't know what was going on. There's nothing to be afraid of. It's a great place to hang out. It's my favorite jhana. There's nothing to bother you. Right? It's just nothing. And it's a really, really concentrated place. So again, you want to be able to hang out there for 5, 10, 15 minutes. Just nothing. At first, it may be a nothing in front of you. If it gets really good, there's nothing in front of you, below you, behind you, above you. Tiny, tiny observer in the middle of nothing. But you won't even notice the observer probably while you're in the jhana. You just notice there's nothing. So, having been there for a while, and by passing entirely beyond the realm of no thingness, one reaches and remains in the realm of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, not a lot there. The word perception is a translation of a Pali word sanya. Sanya means the ability to name things, to identify them. So, can people see the boy sitting under the tree reading? Can you see the boy sitting under the tree? Everybody see the boy sitting under the tree reading? Yeah? No boy under the tree. It's just black and white shapes. All right? The boy sitting under the tree is in your mind. You see these shapes and you go, oh, that looks like a boy sitting under a tree reading. Right? But you can clearly see it's just black and white shapes. The ability to take the black and white shapes and then see it as a boy sitting under a tree is sanya, which is usually translated as perception. I actually prefer to translate it as conceptualization. You see these shapes and you conceive of it, you make a concept of boy sitting under a tree reading. All right? So this eighth jhana is neither sanya nor not sanya, neither perception nor non-perception, neither conceptualizing nor not conceptualizing. That's probably not real helpful. Okay, so part of conceptualizing is naming, right? You name it boy sitting under a tree. So neither naming nor not naming. Yeah. Kind of hard to explain what this is about. The eighth jhana is the state where there's just really nothing you can say about it. It doesn't have any characteristics that you can use to identify it, other than the fact that your mind is in a state that doesn't have any characteristics that you could identify where it is. I know that's not real helpful either. The good news is, if you're good at 7, and you've got to be really good at getting to this realm of no thingness, nice, big, stable, nothing. Right? Big nothing. Let it collapse and come to rest in front of your face and see if your mind goes into a state, but you can't describe where you are, but you can stay there. It doesn't have anything you can perceive, can conceptualize, can identify. And yet, your mind will stay in this state where you're not doing any conceiving or perceiving. It's a very subtle state, far more fragile than the previous jhanas. In each of the other jhanas, say for example the third jhana, you have the object, contentment in the third, and your one-pointed focus on it, right? And you might wobble a little bit. You start to drift off, and you get back. It's not like you start to drift off and the contentment completely disappears. I mean, if you go for very long, it's going to be gone, and when you come back, nope. But if you're there and you wobble a little bit, it starts to go away and you get back, and then it wobbles a little bit and you come back. This can even happen in the seventh jhana. You got nothing, you got your attention on the nothing, and you go away just a little bit and you get back. In the eighth jhana, you might have time for one simple sentence that doesn't contain the words I, me, or mine. All right, this is really fragile. I couldn't tell you the number of times I get into the eighth jhana and I think, yeah, this is good. I got it really good this time. And I'm there, and then I'm in the middle of some paragraph of distraction. I have no clue how I got here, and there's no trace of the eighth jhana left at all. I either have to go back to seven or five and then work my way back up and come back into eight. It was probably, about a year of practicing the eighth jhana before I ever got into it for as long as I wanted. I learned it on a retreat with Ayakema that was 5.5 weeks long, and I learned it in the first week. So I had a whole month to practice it. But even then, it was still fragile after practicing it for a month. And then I had some access to it during the next year until I went on retreat with Aya again. For a month long. It was probably the third week of that month-long retreat before I ever got into the eighth jhana, and I knew I could stay as long as I wanted, and I stayed about half an hour. And it's very rare I've ever been back to that depth of the eighth jhana. Really, really fragile state. It has that quiet peacefulness that the fourth jhana has. But you can't identify quiet peacefulness or anything like that because the mind is just that still. There's nothing really going on. It's even less than nothing going on. So these are the higher jhanas. It appears from the suttas that the four jhanas are sufficient. As we saw last night, after the fourth jhana, one practices insight. And also after the fourth jhana, one overcomes the asavas and becomes fully awakened. These higher jhanas seem to take somebody to an even deeper place. So if you can practice them, you have a mind that's even more concentrated, clearer, sharper, brighter, more malleable, more wieldy, more given to imperturbability. So it can be more useful. I do notice a difference between coming out of the fourth jhana and coming out of the eighth jhana. But yeah, get whatever you can get. And you probably want to get really good at the first four before you try and move on to number five. The move from the fourth jhana to the fifth jhana is the most difficult one of all. Five to six is pretty easy. Six to seven, not too difficult. Seven to eight is easy if you've got a really good seven. There is a state that is sometimes referred to as the ninth jhana. It is never called that in the suttas, although the state is mentioned in the suttas. There it's called the state of the cessation of feeling and perception. Nirodha is the word for cessation. You might be somewhat familiar with that word. All right, so Nirodha Vedana Sanya, cessation of feeling and perception. And it's a state of suspended animation. You might have heard of these yogis in India. They like dig a pit, and put them in a box, and cover up the pit, leave them there for a week and uncover it, and they get out and they're all fine. They didn't go crazy and they didn't die. They're in the state of suspended animation. They're in this state of Nirodha, the so-called ninth jhana. Now you have to be careful with the word Nirodha. Did I mention I wrote a book on the jhanas? I wrote a book on the jhanas, and I talk about the state of Nirodha in there. And I actually identified, I think it's seven different uses of the word Nirodha, or cessation, in the literature. And only one of them refers to this state. But it says in the suttas that people are at the third stage of awakening, or fourth stage, which is full awakening, can stay in the state of Nirodha for up to a week. Now, this has been misinterpreted that only people at the third or fourth stage can enter the state, but that's just misreading what it's actually saying. If you're going to stay for a week, you better get to the third or fourth stage, but you can enter this state for shorter periods of time. There's a video, it's a documentary of the Kumbh Mela Festival, which is a festival they hold in India every 12 years. And this documentary was shot in 2001. Something like 20 million people came to the festival, right? Kind of a big deal, right? And the documentary is very interesting. It's entitled Shortcut to Nirvana. And it's got the Dalai Lama, it's got all these sadhus. It's very, very interesting. And at one point, they show that they dug a big pit, and they put a ladder down into the pit, and this Japanese woman climbs down the ladder, and they pull the ladder out, and then they get roofing tin, and they put it over the pit, and then they cover the roofing tin with dirt. End of scene. And then you get some more sadhus, and you know. And then a little while later, 3 days' time, actually, they come back, and they're sweeping away the dirt, and they remove the roofing tin, and they put the ladder down, and the Japanese woman comes out all happy and fine. She obviously was in the state of Nirodha for those 3 days. I think if they put me down in a pit for 3 days, go a little crazy, right? But yeah, she was fine. So definitely recommend the documentary just for itself, but it's interesting to see this. Another experience I had of Nirodha, I was in Chiang Mai, Thailand once for Thai New Year's. Thai New Year's is at the end of the hot season, the beginning of the rainy season, and it's actually in April. And at that time, the Thais do their spring cleaning. And one of the things they would do in every Buddhist household, there would be a Buddha shrine, and they would wash the Buddha statue. Well, the custom developed that they would take some of the water from washing the Buddha statue, and then they would sprinkle it on the hands of their elders to salute their Buddha nature. Well, in modern times, the sprinkling has gotten a bit out of hand, with everybody in the country throwing buckets of water on everybody else in the country. It's a very participatory festival. There are no observers. You step out of the door of your guest house and you're greeted with a bucket of water. You better have your own bucket. All right? So I was there in Chiang Mai, and it was, it's like, first thing in the morning, it's 30 degrees, and it's going to get hotter, maybe up to 38 by the time it gets to the middle of the afternoon, so it's not a big deal. And I went down to the main square, and along the street that comes along by the main square, the Thais had set up these water pipes and spigots, and they would put barrels under them. And if you put in a 1 baht coin, out would come water. And they would see me coming, and they would go, 1 baht, 1 baht, and that's about 4 cents, right? So I put in a 1 baht coin, and out comes the water, and I could refill my bucket, because of course I'd already used it up just walking to the square, right? And so it's kind of a chaotic scene, because if a bus comes along, people are throwing water in the windows of the buses. You come along on your motorcycle, people are throwing water on you. And there are pickup trucks driving around with big barrels of water in the back, and people throwing water at you as they drive around. Of course, you have to throw water back at them. And it's chaos. It's absolute chaos. Well, in the main square, off in a corner, not right next to where all the chaos was happening, there was a little pavilion that had been built. And seated in the pavilion was a monk. He was in full lotus, and his eyes were open and downcast, and he had the most serene look on his face I had ever seen. It was really quite inspiring to see somebody meditating with all this chaos going on around him. He was still that afternoon when the big parade came through. He was there that night when they had the first round of the beauty pageant, like 30 meters away. He was there the next day, all day long, all this chaos going on. Hadn't moved a bit. He was there on the third morning. He looked a little tired, serenely tired. He was there that afternoon when the biggest parade of all came by. He was there that night when they had the finals of the beauty pageant. He was gone the next day. He had to be in the state of Naroda to sit there through all of this chaos going on around him. It was really quite inspiring to see. The other experience I can tell you about the state of Naroda. Well, first, I read an interesting article by Rod Bucknell, who's a professor of Buddhism in Queensland, Australia. And I've mentioned earlier that there are the jhanas as described in the suttas, and then there are the jhanas as described in the Visuddhimagga, the commentaries. And they're different. And this is what this paper was about. He was saying, yeah, these are different states. And furthermore, he said that the so-called ninth jhana, the state of Naroda, actually corresponds to the first Visuddhimagga jhana. That you can go through the sutta jhanas up to number 8, and then you can go into the first Visuddhimagga jhana by going into Naroda. And I thought that was quite interesting because at the time I had, never ever attempted to practice the Visuddhimagga stuff. But then I sat, two retreats with Powell. The second one was part of a very long retreat that I did. I had been at the Forest Refuge for 2.5 months before he came. And then he was there for 4 months. So I actually had, half a year of practice by the time he left. And as I mentioned, you have to get the nimitta, the circle of light. Well, since I had 2.5 months of practice when he showed up, it only took another month before I was getting a stable nimitta. And so he says, good, keep practicing. It's just, all right. So, I'm doing the counting, and then I'm just, sitting there in what I call access concentration for hours. And then we get the nimitta. And he said, don't look at the nimitta until it becomes the same as your breath. So it was, it was a little bit in front of my face. And he said, it'll come to here. And at that point, because you're watching the breath, you'll be watching the nimitta. All right. So I sat around for another month waiting for my nimitta to come in. And then one day, the nimitta got really bright. I mean, this was vivid. It's like, I'm going to look at it. And as soon as I did, it was 45 minutes later. I mean, I was just like gone. I only guessing at the 45 minutes. I mean, I looked at the nimitta and it was like really good. And then, clearly some time had passed. I had my little timer here, unfortunately, which I left on beep. So it beeped at the end of the sitting. But I had it on vibrate, and it was just sitting there on the desk in my room, and it would vibrate, and so I would know when to quit counting. And I was counting for an hour at that time. And it had not vibrated before I looked at the nimitta. And then when I came out of that state, I looked at the clock, and it had been an hour and a half since I sat down. So it was less than an hour when I first looked at the nimitta, and now it was an hour and a half when I came out, and I'm guessing that I was in there for about 45 minutes. There were no body sensations, there were no sounds, and there was no passage of time. As I said, I looked at it, and then it was 45 minutes later. There was no vedana, and there was no sanya, no perception. So, this was a state of cessation. So I go to Powell next time I have an interview, and I tell him what happened, and he says, good, do for 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. He didn't say it was the first jhana, but he had a Canadian, a French-Canadian monk with him, Ujjagara. And I had an interview with Ujjagara the next morning, and Ujjagara was sitting in on all the interviews with Pao Ox. So the next morning, I go see Ujjagara, and he confirms, yes, that's the first jhana. So I go back to my room. I know exactly what I did. I set up all the conditions. I get the really vivid nimitta again, and I'm going to watch what happens. Well, it took me 3 days to figure out, if you try and watch what happens, nothing happens. All right, so don't watch what happens. Like, don't think of a pink elephant, right? Never got back there, right? I mean, I never got the 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. Tried for another month. Yeah, I got some pretty good meditation happening. I'd get the nimitta and I'd stay there, but it would never absorb like it did that first time. But what would happen, I would fall off into the second jhana, or the third, or the fourth. And then it was like, okay, forget about the nimitta. It was second, third, or fourth jhana from the suttas. But it was really, really deep. And so I would do those and then do some insight practice. And then the next day I'd try again and, yeah, get the nimitta, but it would never absorb, and I'd fall off into another jhana from the suttas and practice those and then do some insight. And that was the rest of my retreat, which wasn't bad, even though I didn't get back there. But certainly the first Visuddhimagga jhana, this complete absorption, was a state of the cessation of feeling and perception. Now, you might be wondering, all right, if that's the first one, what are the rest of them like? Okay, so since you're not there when you're in the jhana, you don't know where you are when you're in it. It's only when you come out that you can tell where you were. And Pao Ox said, look at your heart center. And I said, okay, you look at your heart center, and he goes, no, here. Here, okay. So when I came out of that, I looked at my heart center. Now I've got my eyes closed and I look down here. If you've had your eyes closed for a long time and you look down, you'll get a little bit of light leakage. Except that's supposed to be the reflection of the nimitta. All right, so I saw the reflection of the nimitta. And then he said you could see the factors of the jhana you were in. And so when I first looked down, this wave of piti sukha came over me. I was like, okay, that's piti and sukha, all right, that's good. And then I'm supposed to see vitaka and vichara. Remember, in the Visuddhimagga, it means initial and sustained attention to the meditation object. It doesn't mean thinking. So could I see initial attention? Well, yeah, I saw the nimitta and I put my attention on it. Could I see sustained attention? Well, yeah, that's all there was sustained attention. And then there's a fifth factor in the Visuddhimagga, one-pointedness. Could I see one-pointedness? Yeah, right. That's all there was the nimitta. I was one-pointed on it. And since I could see all five of them, that meant I saw I was in the first jhana. Apparently, if you come out of the second jhana, you don't see initial and sustained attention. All you see is the piti sukha and one-pointedness. And when you come out of the third jhana, all you see is sukha and one-pointedness. And when you come out of the fourth jhana, all you see is equanimity and one-pointedness. But I didn't get to those, so I don't know what it's like. Right? But that's how he described it in his lectures and in his book. But yeah, just get the first four. That's really good. If you get to the next four, that's very good. Forget about number nine. It doesn't seem to be that useful because you're just gone. Yeah, when you come out, you're pretty concentrated, but yeah. So, questions, comments?
Can nimitta actually appear in any of the jhanas?
Nimitta can appear if you're well concentrated. So what Pao Ox was looking for was the nimitta appearing in what I call access concentration. And he actually said access concentration wasn't until the nimitta appeared and was stable. So that was his definition of access concentration. But yeah, it could show up in any of the jhanas. It could show up in any of them. It probably won't show up in the higher ones, 5, 6, 7, 8. And it couldn't show up in 7 because there's nothing. And if you see a nimitta, that's not nothing. on that first retreat with Powok, when I would, you know, smile at the end of the sitting and get into the jhanas, I couldn't get into the seventh because although I'd been working to get to the nimitta earlier and not getting it, when I went from five to six and tried to go to seven, all I got was a nimitta and I couldn't get to seven. So, but yeah, a nimitta can show up in access or in any of the first four.
When you have meditated for science, what has the findings when you have been in higher jhanas in your brain?
Yeah, we don't have much good data. In the fMRI, we have one run with me in the fifth jhana that has been analyzed, and it looks different from the others. And I don't know what the differences are. And then we have a couple more runs with me in the fifth jhana that haven't been analyzed. So we don't have 6, 7, 8 in fMRI. I did do them one time, but they ran out of recording space, and so I didn't get 6, 7, and 8. With EEG, I've seen those, and each jhana looks different, right? So you look at the first, and it looks different from the second, and it looks different from the third, all the way up to 8. But I don't know what the differences mean. So, yeah, it doesn't look like the first four, and 5 doesn't look like 6, and 6 doesn't look like 7, etc. But that's all I can tell you. Yeah. I'm still trying to get the neuroscientists who can analyze the data to analyze the data so we can see what's going on. We have a lot more data recorded than has been analyzed. But hopefully, some point, somebody will decide to take a look at it.
Is there anything like the jhanas in Zen literature?
I haven't found any mention of the jhanas in Zen literature.
Why is that?
That I don't know. It's very interesting because the word jhana is Pali, and it means to meditate, literally. And then in Sanskrit, it's jhana, with a D. In Chinese, it's chan. And in Japanese, it's zen. But there's no jhanas as altered states of consciousness in Zen. The jhanas do show up in the Tibetan literature, and there they're described much like in the Visuddhimagga. I don't think that the Tibetans got it from the Visuddhimagga or the Visuddhimagga got it from the Tibetans. They probably got it from something else that was in India that went to both Sri Lanka and Tibet that's been lost. So they talk about the jhanas in their literature in the Tibetan tradition, but they don't seem to practice them. I have yet to encounter anybody in the Tibetan tradition that practices jhanas other than Alan Wallace. And he apparently says he learned his jhanas from someplace else, not the Tibetan tradition. So yeah, it seems like they're only really showing up in the Theravadan tradition.
Two questions. One is from the Anapanasati, the instructions Buddha gave about the jhanas. He said when you are coming to rapture, you breathe in rapture and you breathe out rapture. Doesn't it?
It says, yeah, the Anapanasati Sutta describes 16 steps. And step 5 is piti, rapture. And it says, breathing in, one is aware of piti. Breathing out, one is aware of piti. And then the step 6 is breathing in, one is aware of sukha. Breathing out, one is aware of sukha. And so the question arises, is this the jhanas? And there are some teachers who say that the middle 8 steps of the 16 of Anapanasati correspond to the 4 jhanas. I would say that they don't. That it's piti, but it's you're not so fully absorbed into it. You're still working with the breathing. But you've got some piti there that's happening. And then you get some sukha that's happening. So that would be my interpretation. You would find this in a book by Ajahn Buddhadasa entitled Mindfulness with Breathing, which is a very good explanation of the discourse on mindfulness of breathing, the Anapanasati Sutta. And then your other question?
Yeah, it's also in the Anapanasati, it said calming down, mm-hmm. bodily formation and mental formation. What does formation mean?
The bodily formation has been debated by the scholars for quite a while, right? So exactly what that means. Probably it means the physical body, but the Visuddhimagga interprets it to mean the whole of the breathing, beginning, middle, end, gap, beginning, middle, end, gap. So the Visuddhimagga means calm your breathing, but I think it means actually the third step is notice the effect of the breathing on your body. And the fourth step, the calming of the bodily formation, would be to breathe in such a way that your body becomes very calm. Then, in steps 5 and 6, you're to notice piti and sukha. And then in 7, to notice the effect of piti and sukha on the mind. And step 8 is to do whatever calms the mind, which is going to be sukha rather than piti, because piti is agitating. That's the best interpretation I can give you.
Excited, because that will be the hinder.
Right, exactly. Yeah, if as the concentration builds and something starts to happen and you get excited, yeah, it just stopped happening. Yeah, so the good news is that the concentration you build to get to access sort of tone downs your tendency to get excited. So it makes it somewhat easier. Where I'm sitting up here and I got all these people in front of me and yeah.
Do you find jhanas from different traditions than Buddhist tradition? For example, shamanistic traditions or Indian.
Yeah. Certainly the jhanas show up in various forms in the Hindu tradition, since the Buddha was learning them from his teachers. They were already in the Indian culture, and they show up in Hinduism, Advaita, and so forth. They also show up in the Sufi tradition. It was real interesting. I had this student, and he was learning the jhanas really fast. And finally he said, yeah, when I practiced with the Sufis, we did all this. And he actually told me the names for the jhanas. I don't remember anyone but the fifth jhana, which he said was the land of snow and ice. Which, yeah, you get this huge white space. It's the land of snow and ice. So they're well known in the Sufi tradition. They seem to show up in the Christian mystics from the Middle Ages. Some people think that perhaps Teresa de Avila or St. John of the Cross were practicing jhanas. I've read some of their writings. I never saw anything that made me go, oh, that's the jhanas. Okay, so, and then talking with a friend who is he's a Christian mystic. And she's read a lot of St. Teresa and St. John of the Cross. And she says, no, she doesn't find anything with the jhanas in them. But apparently Francisco de Osuna, who was another Christian mystic, describes what sounds very much like the jhanas. I've tried to find his writings, but yeah, I haven't come across anything. In the shamanistic traditions, I haven't heard anything, but I wouldn't be surprised at all. This is how the mind likes to go when it gets quiet. I mean, it's not that I'm a great teacher, it's that you all have human minds. And so I just give you a map and you follow it along and your mind goes in that direction. So many people stumble into them as little kids or have stumbled into them when doing Vipassana. So I wouldn't be at all surprised that they've been found in shamanistic traditions or Taoism or something like that. I just haven't found them except in the Sufis and Francisco de Assuna, the Christian mystics.